So I'm Rick Hansen, and this is an odd experience to have my voice reverberating from the walls of this room. This is the East Bay Open Circle, right? On Sunday, March 7th, Oscar night. I want to acknowledge everyone for being here who is here. I don't pay much attention to that. I doubt Rob does either, but you know, we each got feedback from people when we sent out word about this. Gee, it's Oscar night, don't you know? Sorry. Anyway, it's great, you're here. Okay. So actually, it's kind of ironic, isn't it, that the Oscars, which is so much a celebration of self in so many ways, is occurring as we're here looking at the causes and conditions of self, or as I often describe it, selfing, as they arise in the mind, in the brain, and interpersonally, as well as the causes and conditions that lead to its end, with the happiness and harmlessness that ensues. And so isn't it interesting that we're here tonight to do that while this other celebration is going on, which has, of course, other aims as well. Okay, so my intent is to, present some information for probably about 15-ish, 20-ish minutes with some discussion about the mind and the brain, because I'm going to talk about how understanding something about how the brain works and its relationship with the mind, and I'll define those murky terms at least as I use them in a moment or two, how understanding something of how self is constructed within the nervous system and deconstructed, if you will, can give us some of the keys to how to undo it. And so then after that, I'm going to do a practice with you if you're willing to do it with me. And you don't have to do, by the way, any kind of practices here, but I'll propose an experiential activity. Which will be both meditative and an investigation into the actual nature of self as it's experienced directly. And then we'll talk about the implications of that, which I'll then use as a segue into some, I think, very cool material about self in the brain, or not self in the brain. Where is the self in the brain, right? And then we can explore those implications. Then I'm going to explore as well some very interesting research about different sort of major circuits, freeway systems of neural traffic, if you will, that get activated when we're in a very self-referential mode, you know, really taking things personally or planning to get something for ourselves, versus when we're in a minimal, who knows, even non-existent self-activation mode, which then goes to things we can do to promote the neural substrate of that latter mode, which can then free us from some of the hegemony, you know, the tyranny, if you will, and the entanglements of the self. And then, so we'll do some experiential stuff toward the end, too. And then I definitely intend to end by 9 o'clock. If you can stay till 9, that's great. If you need to leave early, so be it. But I like to minimize that trickle of people, you know, racing out a few minutes early, because it is a little disruptive. And to a speaker, I admit it, I still have enough self-invested in this. It is a little unnerving. But that said, if you need to leave, it's really cool. Okay? Sound all right? Plan. That's our plan. It's getting a little warm in here, at least for me, so I'll start disrobing. I'll stop here. It's not the Oscars. I won't go any further. So, okay. So, and by the way, if you like, you can get on my email list, if you're not already, for the Wise Brain Bulletin, which comes out monthly from the institute I founded. I should say a word about myself. So obviously I'm Rick Hansen. I'm a neuropsychologist, a licensed psychologist, and I started meditating in 1974 and have had a long interest in happiness and unhappiness. I saw a lot of the latter in my upbringing in a kind of regular middle class environment in Southern California, both in my family but especially out there in the world. And so I got interested early on in, how come people seem so bummed out and tense and frazzled and squeezing the happiness out of the air so much of the time, seemingly needlessly, with a kind of wide-eyed, of a young kid. And then that set me on a journey ever since. So I graduated UCLA in 1974, the height of the human potential movement, dove into that full bore. After about 10 years of that and some business consulting along the way, so I have some groundedness in my background, believe it or not, I realized, I should go to graduate school, light bulb moment. So I did, and I also got very interested in developmental psychology, which is a very interesting frame in which to consider the development of self, if you will, both linked to neurological maturation as well as the social construction of that in relationships. And then along the way, I got quite, I've been, in terms of the non-dual part of this, because I think there's a lot of interest in this room and in this group here in non-dual perspectives. When I read things like Alan Watts, The Taboo Against Knowing Who You Are, or a fair amount of Buddhism, it just was immediately apparent to me that it really was all one, in kind of a Vedanta sense. And I'm not going to push any of you here tonight, but I think that, and I think most fundamentally, it's important to see for ourselves, okay, what really is true. But there was an immediate conviction for myself. And then additionally, I had a teacher for quite some time, Lovananda Adida Dhafri John, who's quite a non-dual teacher in his own way, no longer alive. Kind of a mixed bag there in some ways. I didn't get too caught up in the craziness. I had some brushes with different things early on that kind of inoculated me against cultism to some extent, so I was pretty good. And then I got very engaged with Buddhism starting about 15 or 20 years ago. I was on the board of Spirit Rock Meditation Center here in the Bay Area for 9 years, and I teach there frequently in terms of day longs. Don't lead retreats there, but do teach day longs there. And I find that the intersection really of the contemplative traditions, Western psychology, and modern neuroscience are just a phenomenal, fantastic. Right at the center of those three circles is kind of the heartwood, I think. That's the bullseye, because of these three traditions, which come at this from such different perspectives, all seem to be kind of pointing at the same thing, particularly when you sort of translate between the language, you figure, whoa, that's fertile ground. So that's kind of background here. All right, and by the way, I recently wrote a book called Buddha's Brain. You may know about it. Subtitle describes it well. The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. And I brought some books here if you want to get one. It's cool. It's on the honor system, $20. Leave it in the envelope, and it's on your head if you take one without leaving any money. I've actually never said that before, but anyway. Let's see. It's irrelevant. Also, where did I start? The Wellspring Bulletin, yes. So I founded this institute a few years ago, the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom. And one of the things it does is it publishes the Wellspring Bulletin. It also has a website called wellspring.org that's got tons of resources that are freely offered. And so if you want to get on the email list for that bulletin, as well as for a weekly newsletter I do called Just One Thing, which is about a simple practice to change your life. The one this week is smile. The one last week was get more sleep. I tried to take that advice. One before that was take more breaks. I don't know. It's pretty mellow. So if you want that, and I don't share your address with anybody, the email address will be in a pad at the back table back there. Okay. And on both wisebrain.org as well as my personal website, rickhanson.net, I'll be posting this talk, and it'll go up in a few days. All right, let's get into it. Okay, so the brain, the mind, what's going on with all that crazy stuff? So, who knows? So, there's a great quote I like to keep in mind here. It's from Tenzin Palmo. Ani Tenzin Palmo is an English woman who spent 12 years in a cave in Tibet, as well as another 12 years on retreat in other ways. And she says, we ask, what is a thought? We don't know, yet we are thinking continually. So even though I will say some things tonight that are based on the most current Western science, at least as I know it, nonetheless, the truth is that we're really at a great frontier here in terms of what's being discovered about the brain and the mind. It's interesting to realize that the amount of knowledge that brain scientists have about the brain has essentially doubled in the last 20 years. We know twice as much today than we did in 1990. Like, it's hard to realize that 1990, you know, was 20 years ago. It's kind of scary for me when I look in the mirror. But anyway, and so, you know, it's in that context that I want to talk now about some of the basics about the brain. Then I'm going to talk about the brain-mind relationship. Then let's do a practice. Okay, so the brain. Kind of wild to, I think of this as sort of like the brain, the 411, as they say in Australia, you know, the basic facts. 3 pounds, roughly, of tofu-like tissue right between the ears. Got 1.1 trillion cells total. 100 billion of them are neurons, surrounded by another trillion support cells. All those cells matter. We don't use 10% of our brain. We use 100% of our brain. Mother Nature would never produce such a metabolically expensive organ, and one that the size of which is often lethal to mothers in childbirth, by the way. She would not be doing that if that brain were not necessary, all of it. And increasingly, scientists are starting to discover that the glial cells, or astrocytes, in other words, the 1 trillion cells that are not neurons, actually have very important functions. It reminds me somehow of a Zen saying, nothing left out, right? And so I think it's important to not leave out the other trillion cells. That said, I'm also going to talk about the neurons. So a typical neuron, it's like a little switch, basically. It receives inputs at one end to simplify, and then based on the moment-to-moment summation of those inputs, it sends signals down, you know, the tail end, if you will, which connects with other neurons. A typical neuron makes about 5,000 connections with other neurons. That means that inside my brain and yours are about 500 trillion synapses. Okay? Typical neuron is sending signals 5 to 50 times a second, ballpark. That means that during the duration of a signal, single breath, roughly a quadrillion bits of information move between your ears. The brain is incredibly busy. Even though it's about 2 to 3% of body weight, it uses 20 to 25% of the glucose and oxygen circulating in our blood. It uses, in other words, roughly 10 times its own body weight in metabolic supplies. So it's a real busy, active thing. One way to appreciate the complexity of the brain, which just always blows my mind because, I don't know, I'm a kind of facts guy and I like numbers too, is that if you take 100 billion neurons that are either firing or not, and then you, therefore, the combination of all those on or off states tells you the total number of possible states of the brain. Does that make sense? In other words, that's kind of like the upper limit of the complexity of the system. If it were a computer system, like a computer network that had these same capacities, we would be thinking, okay, what's the upper limit, fundamentally, of how much information it can hold? Well, the number of potential states of the brain, roughly, is 10 to the millionth power. In other words, one followed by a million zeros. And to put that number in scale, which is really boggling, the estimated number of particles in the entire universe, all the atoms in the whole universe, is 10 to just the 80th power. See that? And the brain, my brain, your brain, is the most complex object known to science. It's really quite extraordinary. So now we have this amazing organ, right between our ears. And I want to talk about the relationship between the brain and the mind, because these subjects, our subjects tonight, self, consciousness, awareness, mind, they're just a, you know, what the Buddha called a thicket of views. It's really easy to have about them. And one way to cut through that thicket is to really clarify what you mean by your words. So I'm going to be trying to do that a fair amount. I've read pretty widely in the non-dual literature, not as much as some. And one thing I've encountered there is sometimes you'll find a word like awareness or non-dual awareness or self used two or three different ways within the same sentence, certainly within the same paragraph. So try not to step into that little bit of a pitfall here. So my mind, I mean the flow of information through the nervous system. Okay? So neurons send signals to each other. The nervous system moves information around, much like the heart moves blood around. Most of that information is forever unconscious. We're only aware of the tip of the iceberg. The sort of slow, congealed stuff we call thought is just one tiny fraction of the totality of mind, broadly defined, within the frame of Western science, within the frame of the human nervous system. Now, if you think about it, apart from hypothetical transcendental factors, the mind is what the brain does. In other words, the brain is the necessary condition for the mind, without, in the terms that I'm using it here. Without the brain, you can't have a mind. If you damage the brain, you're going to damage the mind. Right? Now, I personally am a theist. I think there are transcendental factors. That said, what I've said so far is squarely within the traditions of Western science. But the brain, to be clear though, is only proximally sufficient. I think of it as the necessary and proximally sufficient condition for mind. It's proximally sufficient because it needs the nervous system altogether. The nervous system is embedded in other bodily systems in which it co-dependently arises, like the hormonal system and the immune system, which are very intertwined with the brain. Cardiovascular and nervous system are very intertwined. Even the gastrointestinal system. Some people describe us as having a third brain in the gut because there's so many nerve endings there. So anyway, these systems co-arise interdependently. So therefore, mind depends on all the systems as well. And those systems interact with the whole natural world as well as culture, both immediately and across the vertical dimension of time. So it's in that larger sense that I'm going to talk about the brain and the mind, but I want to kind of use that as an important caveat. It's very interesting that this analysis takes us right to the insights of quantum physics, deep ecology, and of course the ancient contemplative traditions who say that essentially everything is connected to everything else. Nothing arises on its own. Therefore, everything is fundamentally empty, to use the traditional term of absolute self-arising existence. By the way, this is about the heaviest lifting we're going to do intellectually, and momentarily we're going to do a practice. All right, so what's the takeaway point? If you think about it, when the brain changes, the mind changes. When the mind changes, the brain changes. For example, it's not just that the brain makes the mind, but the mind makes the brain. In other words, the flow of mental activity changes neural structure. This is the realm of neuroplasticity. Most neuroplasticity is very pedestrian. It's moment to moment. Like you probably have a vague recollection of, at least, of how I began this talk or what you did earlier today or just what you're feeling right now. That moment to moment experiencing is the fact that you can recall that means that, at least momentarily, the flow of thought changed neural structure. In more enduring ways, though, the flow of thought, broadly defined, the flow of the mind, information moving through the nervous system, leaves lasting residues. In other words, immaterial emotions, thoughts, perspectives, images, memories, desires, longings, hopes, dreams, reflections, and to quote Jung, for example, all of that sculpts neural structure. It does so in a variety of ways. The classic saying in neuroscience, which I really like a lot, from the Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb, is that when neurons fire together, they wire together. All right? So the neurons that are active together, in other words, start making connections. Other ways that mental activity leaves traces behind is that the flow of thought and emotion changes the expression of genes. In other words, in ways that are just remarkable, how we feel somehow, in ways that are deeply mysterious, somehow goes down to and affects units of atoms within the larger molecule of DNA in terms of how they are expressed, for example, in terms of the stress response. Cultivating relaxation as a regular practice improves the expression of the genes that are involved in the stress, in regulating stress. Pretty great. That's epigenetics, right? That's another way that as the mind changes, the brain changes. There's also what's called neuronal pruning, use it or lose it. I mean, if we have 500 trillion neurons today, a three-year-old has about 1.5 quadrillion neurons. In other words, a toddler has about three times as, synapse is what I meant to say. A toddler has about three times as many synapses as an adult does. Isn't that cool? But it's not that we're stupid compared to a toddler, although I think we are sometimes. But anyway, it's just that it's called neural Darwinism or neuronal pruning, use it or lose it. In other words, those synapses, those neurons, and those circuits, if you will, or assemblies of neurons that are active and busy strengthen and develop, whereas the ones that are not so busy or active wither away. Right. The takeaway point for me here is that subjective experience really matters. In other words, one of the things that has been real for me coming from this material is that what happens in my head really matters, not just in the moment, but in the lasting traces it leaves. In other words, if we routinely dwell on our resentments, regrets, feeling hurt by other people, limited, unable, losses, and so forth, if we routinely dwell on those, neurons that fire together wire together, for better or worse. That gradually will incline the mind in the direction of feeling more pessimistic, more despairing, less self-confident, more lower mood, and so forth. On the other hand, if we routinely dwell on the facts, it's a critically important point, the facts that are good news about the world, ourselves, our strengths, our goodness, our good intentions, our virtues, the love that we have received, the things that we can be glad about, the things that we can be grateful for, then neurons that fire together wire together in that way as well, and we will promote greater resilience, self-confidence, positive mood, and very often greater generosity toward others, because interestingly, as Bertrand Russell said, to paraphrase, the good life as I conceive it is a happy one, not because good people are happy people, but rather because happy people are good people. And there's a lot of research that shows, as a generalization with many exceptions, that in general, as people feel more filled up themselves over here and less wounded and desperate and needy, they then are naturally more generous, compassionate, and pro-social toward others. Okay. So the import of all this is that we can use our mind to change our brain to change our mind. In other words, historically it's been understood that if you did mental practice A, you would get mental result C. And it was kind of presumed, especially in the last century or 100 years or so, that mental activity A led to mental result B, or C rather, via the black box of the brain. In other words, mental activity A triggered brain state B, which then led to mental state C. In other words, doing some kind of, let's say, a mindfulness practice, or telling yourself just before you walk in the house when your kids are little that it's showtime and you need to show up, like I would do for myself sometimes, rolling home, that mental activity A triggers a brain state B, which then inclines me more toward being patient and present and all the rest of that. Okay? What's been increasingly clear, though, in the last 20 years, especially the last five or so, is how to actually use mental activity in a very targeted, nimble, and skillful way to affect the black box. In other words, to affect the brain, and as a result of affecting the brain, lead to wholesome states of mind, C. So comments or questions so far? Marvin Minsky has a quote, "The principal activities of brains are making changes in themselves." That's what they did. Okay? Yeah.
So you think the positive state versus the negative state, how does that get us away from duality?
So using the positive state instead of the negative state, how does that get us away from duality? Well, we're already in the deep end of the pool, right? I think that there is a meaningful distinction between the cup and my hand. In that sense, there's a duality here, right? And I think there is a meaningful distinction between coming home from work with young children, looking at the mess in the house, and going grumble, 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 why can't my wife keep this place clean, right? Mental state, one kind of mental state, versus another mental state, which is more on the order of, you know, she's great, she's wonderful, kids are little entropy generators, you know what I mean, right? Little kids just generate disorder and chaos wherever they go, relax, lighten up, don't, you know, win battles but lose wars. I think there's a meaningful distinction between those two states of mind. And now, those states of mind, in a more fundamental sense, are empty of self, of absolute distinctions between themselves and other mental states. And in the way I'm talking about here, mind itself is not fundamentally distinct from the nervous system, the brain, and the world. So the ultimate frame is, if you will, non-dual. But inside that frame, I think there are plenty of, my opinion here, plenty of useful dualistic distinctions, you know, between my car and the other car, right? Between my car and the driveway that I was walking when I first parked here, and then Rob rescued me and enabled me to move my car. You know, there's a distinction between my car blocking the driveway and my car not blocking the driveway. Right? I think it's okay to hold both of us. Yeah, please.
I would enjoy hearing you elaborate a little on, you were saying in the beginning that you consider yourself a theist.
Just to really drag us into the deep end of the pool.
I want to get a sense of how it fits in.
Why don't I do that? And then maybe I'll talk, after I do that, I'll talk a little bit about how something probably most of us do, which is some kind of mindfulness practice or meditative or prayerful practice, some kind of contemplative practice, how that has been shown to change the brain, literally. And then let's take a hard look at this self. Right? So, I guess to be personal, my own sense of the divine is that it is fundamentally the condition of everything. And, yeah. And that everything ranging from George Bush to cupcakes to the thought of my head is a temporary kind of modification of that fundamental condition.
The fundamental condition of what you call?
The divine, the transcendental.
Something beyond.
Yeah, yeah. And, yeah. And I'm not trying to assert that view. I think there are many people who've articulated that much better. But when I read people like Ramana Maharshi or Adyashanti, for example, or I have a lot of resonance with that. There's a lot of technical and but yet not just technical, quite fundamental debate within Buddhism about whether the Buddha himself, particularly as best we can gather from the surviving record of his teachings, which were not, the surviving record didn't come into existence until several centuries after he died, so there's a lot of, you know, time in there for things to change. But there's a significant debate in Buddhism about whether he asserted that there is some ultimate ground, right? And there are some ways of reading what he says. The Mahayana tradition, really fast here, the original teachings of the Buddha are generally thought of in terms of the Theravadin tradition, the Pali Canon. Sometimes people use the term vipassana to equate to that tradition, but all Buddhist traditions use vipassana, which is, just means insight practices. And then around, 400, 500, 600, 700 years after the Buddha died, which is to say around the second or third century of the Common Era, this Mahayana Tibetan Buddhism developed, which then kind of moved through China then to Japan and became Zen as well. So there are probably four major wings of Buddhism: Theravadin, Tibetan, Zen, and Pure Land, which is a kind of a development around Zen. So in that larger frame, some people take the Buddha's words to mean that there is a fundamental ground. Other people say more radically that no, he relentlessly deconstructed people's attempts to cling to some ground, including the ground of some kind of non-dual something or other that we can all be comforted by. He was hardcore, and for better or for worse, right? I myself think there's a way through that that's quite interesting, and I really prefer not to get deeply into that topic, which is to think of the ground not as a thing, in some sense. Yeah, well even as an entity or as a noun, but rather to think of the ground as the nature of things. That's a very interesting way to relate to that, the condition of things. And while there may be no ground in a substantive sense, including some esoteric, exotic, astral realm, substantive sense that is God, whatever, there may well be an enduring nature of things, which at the leading edge of now is emergent, transient, and fundamentally free. Because at the emergent edge of now, as my best friend said, I asked him once, what do you think God is? He said, possibility. And I thought that was a wonderful answer. You know, at the emergent edge of now, it's really interesting to ask ourselves, why doesn't it just all stop? It keeps emerging forever and disappearing forever and ever, right? What is all that? So I wrote an essay about that, which is actually now online at Buddhist Geeks and is in the last issue. It's in about a year ago. I wrote it called Eddies in the Stream. So I think of that for me. And that's a very interesting way to get out of the trap. There is a ground, there is no ground, you know? Well, maybe there is no ground, but there is an endlessly self-renewing nature of things. Now, let's go back to the shallow end of the pool, all right? Some research findings on the thank you. No, these are great. Hopefully this is okay. Anyway, mind changes brain. Well, for example, how many of you have ever meditated or have even an ongoing contemplative or prayerful practice? Very broadly defined. Most of the people in the room. Great. Well, interestingly, of all the mental activities that might have an effect on the brain, meditation is the one that's been studied the most. Partly because it's kind of sexy, partly because people wanted to debunk it, partly because a lot of TM meditators early on really wanted to establish the groundedness of what they were doing. For all kinds of reasons, there's been a lot of research actually, and consistent findings are that this activity we do, or however we do it, we get quiet, or we reflect, or we be with, Maybe we settle into a sense of this ground or this nature of things, this condition, the divine, and what have you. Maybe we just focus on the breath or do loving kindness phrases, whatever it is we do. We have a mantra, who knows? That actually changes the brain in lasting ways. And one of the most robust findings is that it actually thickens neural tissue in the part of the brain that is involved in the control of attention. The anterior, which means frontal, cingulate cortex, kind of in the middle toward the front on both sides. By the way, we have two anterior cingulate cortices. The convention of neuroscience is to always talk about them like there's just one. It's quite confusing, but there really are almost always two. There you go, dualisms, right? You know. But anyway, so that gets thicker. And as a result, people get better at controlling attention. And attention, man, attention is like a combination of spotlight and vacuum cleaner, right? It illuminates what it rests upon, but it just sucks it right into the brain because, yes, neurons that fire together wire together, the ones that are doing so below the waterline do leave neural structure behind. But what is in the field of focal attention is kind of turbocharged in terms of the formation of neural structure because that's what we're consciously attending to, and therefore that's what's really important for us or our primate or mammal or just animal ancestors to look at and to learn from. It's quite clear. I think for me, it only makes sense to talk about this stuff in the context of biological evolution. In other words, the brain has been shaped by 2.5 million years, which is to say about 100,000 generations of stone tool-making ancestors of ours. That's about how long humans or hominid ancestors have been making tools. Well, those early stone tool makers, how many here can make a stone tool? I can't. You can. I'm impressed. I can't. Most people can't. They had brains a third our size. Isn't that amazing? The brain has tripled in size over the last 2.5 million years. And much of that build-out is actually, broadly defined, related to love. It's related to relational capacities like language, cooperative planning, empathy, and the development of self, which we'll come back to, which is a double-edged sword that we'll come back to. The actual evolutionary and adaptive advantages of the sense of self. We'll come back to that. And so, anyways, that's just 2.5 million years. There are about 80 million years, ballpark 60, 80 million years of primates, 100 million ballpark years of mammals, 600 million years of evolution of the nervous system. What a long, strange trip it's been. Yeah? So, anyway, here we are. So the point is that along the way, our ancestors really needed to learn from their experiences. And one way to learn was to focus awareness. Now we're talking the awareness of a mosquito, or the awareness of a frog that's eating the mosquito, or the awareness of a cat attending to a mouse, or the awareness of a human watching the cat pursue the mouse and deciding to intervene to rescue the mouse, because I'm a softie that way. You know, that's all happening inside the brain in ways that are completely mysterious still, which then leads to neural structure based on focal attention. And so when we meditate, we build neural structures that control attention, which is good for anybody. Another major result of neural structure developing through meditation is in terms of the insula, which is a part of the brain that tracks the internal state of the body, gut feelings, and is also very involved in empathy with other people. So, for example, interestingly, if we tune into ourselves routinely, we actually get better at reading our partner, our prospects, our customers, our coworkers, God help us, our parents. As they say, you know, if you really want to see how far along your practice is, go home and see your parents, if they're still alive, or go home and see your children, go see your children, either way, works, or anybody else. So, there you go. Or watch Dick Cheney on Fox News. You know, that's how you can really see where you are in your practice. Okay, so speaking of which, how about we do a practice, all right? And so then we'll talk about self and how it causes suffering and how seeing through it can actually lead to less suffering and harm for ourselves and other people. So like all practices, feel free to ignore my suggestions or adapt them, go your own way. If you start feeling uncomfortable, feel very free to change it. I will use the breath initially, the sensations of breathing, as an object of attention, whoops. But for some people, particularly those who've had a fair number of painful experiences, even traumatic ones, paying attention to the breath can be quite alarming. And so feel very free to alter my suggestions to whatever works for you. All right, you can do this with your eyes open or closed. Just to give you a heads up, What I'm going to suggest that you do in the beginning is just sit quietly, do a couple things in your mind that I'll suggest, and then I'm going to suggest that you open your eyes, do a couple more things, then I'm going to suggest that you stand up, and then I'm going to suggest that you move around a little bit, look around a little bit, then come back down again, and then we'll talk about it. Okay? What this is about is exploring the direct phenomenology of self. In other words, the actual experience of the sense of I, or me, or mine, right here and now. So of all the objects moving through awareness, in particular, try to be aware of anything that seems related to that sense of me, your history, your desires, even the subtlest sense of being a being looking out through your eyes. All right, so let's begin. So take a big breath. A long exhalation and relax. A few more of these. And we're really going to explore here what it's like to breathe, to be aware, to see, to stand, and even to move with as little sense of self as possible. So keep exploring what it's like to be present, to be awake, to be alive, with little sense of being a Rick, a Susie, a Bob, a Joe, a Juan, Maria. What's this like? And one way into this is to really relax, because we'll see the sense of self tends to strongly activate around stress and great opportunity or great threat. So if we exhale, that activates the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system, which is very calming to the stress system. Good. Allow yourself to settle into a growing sense of well-being as it is there for you. When I use words like you or I or self, I'm referring to the person altogether, not to any presumed subject of experience or agent of actions. Resting here, aware of various contents of mind flowing through, like sounds, sensations, explore a practice of from time to time gently noting along the lines of sound or sensation or even self or ego, or maybe say there is sound, there is thought, there is emotion. While at the same time, if you like, asking yourself, there is sound. Does there need to be self here for sound? Does there need to be an I for there to be an experience of sound? We'll take a couple minutes here in quiet just to explore the flow of mental objects, the flow of material through awareness, observing what's there, and questioning whether self, I, needs to be present for there to be the flow of experience. gazing on the floor, not making eye contact with anyone. And just observe what happens when you move your head gently, let's say, and let different objects come into the field of awareness. It's self-needed for vision. You might also notice that some sights have a pleasant quality, others have an unpleasant quality, many are neutral. This is the feeling tone in Buddhism or the hedonic tone in Western psychology. And you can ask yourself as well, is self needed for there to be a feeling tone to experience? Notice commentaries arising in the mind, streams of verbal thought, ideas, views. Again, ask, is self necessary for views to arise? And observe the degree to which there is identification with views, perspectives, ideas, language. Ask you to stand up, move in place, and see what's involved in the motor act of standing. Moving forward initially, shifting your weight to your feet, and gradually standing. Keep observing. There is sensation, there is movement, there are executive decisions to stand or not. Need there be self here to stand? And then once you come to standing, take another couple minutes in quiet to experience and explore moving gently from side to side, letting your gaze move around, maybe lifting your hands, moving your body in various ways, continuing to experiment with whether self needs to be present to act. So if you're willing, gently come standing, take your time, keep observing sensation and self. Take a minute or so here to explore movement without needing a self. you like. Let your gaze move around some and glance over the eyes of other people, and especially be aware of what happens in terms of self-activation when you make eye contact with other people. It's all right to turn in place, to be able to see other people. See what happens to selfing when eye contact is made. Come on back to your chair, and as you sit, does there need to be a self to sit? And in a moment, how about we talk a bit about this, and as language starts coming back in, particularly using language yourself, notice what that's like. In other words, there is language here. There is verbal thought. There is directed thought. Does there need to be a self in that sense of an I or an ego or a me to produce language? Okay? So I'd like to ask you what your experience was, and let's try to keep this very close to the actual experience, right, and not get conceptual as much as possible. So what did you experience doing that practice? Yeah, Rob. Okay, great. Okay, so the charge that arose, and I'll swing back to those points, when there was contact with others, right? And when there was a lot of thinking.
When there was
an involvement with thinking or identification with thinking, right? That fair way to say it. And then also when there was something that was wanted, right? Okay. How about other people? What did you experience? Yeah, right here.
I didn't find that I was aware of the self when I was looking around in the thing. When I caught people's eyes, immediately a huge amount of action. I was very much aware of my being self, wanting to experiment by seeing what effect that was having. The more I looked, the more I should look to find out. Then all sorts of thoughts started to come about what were they thinking of my looking at them. Then it started to go off and get metaphors, and it was uncomfortable, which is not my normal feeling.
Which was uncomfortable? Being present with people or getting caught in the hall of mirrors about selfing, self-observing self? Or, yeah, that can be a little contracted, yeah. It's like a college dorm exercise when you've had way too many drugs, right? You know, who's looking at the one who's looking at the one who's looking at the one? Wow, you know, you can kind of go there. But I'm not saying that was what was happening there, but it just reminds me of that a little bit. Sometimes we can get caught. I have a teacher, Gil Fronsdal, who says that this dynamic around self or awareness is a little bit like, it's almost like your own shadow or something, that it, as soon as you look at it, it goes away, but you mostly just have to have an intimation, as you clearly did, of some of the ways that it arises and disperses.
I was aware of choices and judgments.
Yeah. That's right. Thank you. Okay, maybe another few people? Yeah.
Yeah.
notice any increase or decrease in your sense of self when you made eye contact with other people? Yeah, you. Right, right. Okay, thank you. Roger. Uh-huh. Yeah. Right. Was there identification with that quiet curiosity, or was there simply quiet curiosity present? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That little verbal practice of there is, you know, quiet curiosity, rather than I am quietly curious, is a very useful method. All right, right in front of you, right there. Yeah, please. Yeah, and, or often, additionally, I don't know if that's true for you, but people often report, you know, wondering how they're, what they're seeing over here. What do I look like? How, who do you think I am? You know, or are you looking at me? You know, that kind of stuff. Well, that's interesting. We'll see, and I'll talk about how I'm using those terms in a moment, which is in a very conventional Western psychological way. In other words, yeah. Why don't we just do a couple more experiential things and then we can get a little more conceptual. How about right there? Okay, thank you. Got it. Maybe one more, right there. Yes. Yes. Embarrassment is one of the so-called social emotions. In other words, it's fundamentally it's embedded in a context that's typically about a lot of self. Shame is another one of those social emotions. Yeah, that's very interesting, isn't it? Well, thank you. So, if you think about it, what's happened here is that you had a series of experiences, whatever they were, with self and so forth. And so what I'd like to do is kind of clarify some of the way I'm using these terms and then talk about the conventional Western notion of the psychological self and then ask, was it actually present in your own experience? And then we'll talk about how self is in the brain, which is really like the Twilight Zone. All right. So I define the person as the body-mind as a whole. Person has history, person has moral standing, person has moral culpability and responsibility. We should treat persons well. And we make distinctions in ethics and in law and in everyday life between what we grant personhood to or not. All right? Without getting into this topic, obviously there's a lot of debate about whether a fetus at the moment of conception is a person in the same way that someone who is born. So the question of what is a person is a pretty important question. So that's a person. self is that sense of I, me, or mine that is the unified, enduring agent of actions and owner of experiences. That's the sense of self in Western psychology. In other words, that it's the same one over the years, looking out through the eyes. It's coherent. It's just one. Okay, so it's coherent, it's unified, it's stable, it's independent, and it's who we are. That's the conventional notion of self. Just four fundamental properties. So just to go through those again. That it's unified, in other words, it's coherent. Second, it's enduring and unchanging. Third, it's independent. In other words, things happen, but it persists. It is, you know, it's kind of the ground across which all kinds of figures of our life move. And then last, it is, that's who I am, right? That's me. That's what is most intimately identified with, all right? That's what I mean by self. And kind of that's the Western psychological view. And then I also want to define the word awareness, because that gets particularly tricky, particularly in a non-dual framework. I think of awareness as the field in which the mind, as yet mysteriously, represents aspects of itself to itself. Awareness requires a kind of recursive quality for things to be re-presented back to the mind. And I'm not making awareness the same as some ultimate transcendental ground of capital C consciousness. I'm thinking of awareness here as essentially the same in its fundamentals as the awareness of my cat looking at a mouse, squirrel looking at a nut, a frog being aware of the movement of a fly. In that context, if you really ask yourself, what was your actual experience? In other words, for example, did you have a sense that self, I, me, mine, was uniform, was unified? Or did you have the sense that there were parts of the self, if you will, that came to the fore at different moments depending on what you're doing? For example, little sense of self and then making eye contact, little sense of self and then wanting something intensely, or different aspects of the self, the young self, the old self, the wise self, the greedy self, what have you. Right? That's the actual experience of things. In other words, self is compounded. It's made of many parts. To me, I think that's what people routinely experience when they look closely at the sense of I, or me, or mine. The second thing is that I, me, or mine is very impermanent. It's transient, right? You saw that. Standing up, sitting down, moving, looking left, looking right. Self is very changing, constantly changing. The self today is quite different from the self of an 8-year-old, all right? Think about the self who sets the alarm clock at night to get up early to exercise, and then the self who says, who set the clock? The self is very transient, very changeable. Third, the actual experience of self is that it arises dependently. In other words, the self, the personality, if you will, or the sense of me, is based on all kinds of causes and conditions in life, both historically and in the moment. Just for example, the amount of self that was present changed depending on the instructions suggestions I gave, right? So in that sense as well, self does not arise independently, but self is embedded in a very non-dual way in a whole network, Indra's net, if you will, this whole cosmic web of causes and conditions that give rise to its manifestation at any moment in time. If you think about it, like what a lot of people observe, and I think Rob, for example, highlighted it, self arises, I think of self as, in different aspects of self, as sort of like the circuit board of an amplifier. When it's playing a song, different parts go up or go down, like the lights go red, red, green, green, down, depending on which instruments you're playing or something like that. The same is the sense of self, right? It goes up or down. Well, what are the sorts of things that self really organizes around? It organizes around strong desires, and it organizes around the interpersonal field. You can just see that. Yes, self desires, but very often it's actually desiring, wanting, that constellates the self. That's actually, in my personal experience, a very useful thing to be aware of in any kind of a mindfulness practice, is to watch the cascade of selfing on a time clock of seconds. For example, in the brain, or the mind, we can be aware of usually around 4 to 6 discrete thoughts per second when the mind's pretty quiet, which interestingly probably corresponds to the rate at which the neural substrate of working memory in the upper outer frontal portions of the brain re-updates. In other words, you know, like a computer monitor, it has this sort of sweep across it. It re-updates, it refreshes its refresh rate. It refreshes so fast that it looks continuous, you know, like 22 frames per second in a movie look continuous. But the neural substrate of working memory, which is to say the basis of awareness in our experience, refreshes about 6 times a second, which does interestingly give rise to that quality in our experience that it feels granular, kind of discrete, in part because it's refreshing. My little theory is that the refresh rate accelerates intensely in a crisis, like a car accident, or speaking personally, falling while rock climbing. And that's why people have the experience that in an emergency, time slows down. Because if you speed up the number of images per second, you slow the movie down. Make sense? Isn't that kind of neat to think about? Anyway, in that context in which we can observe multiple things happen, we can watch something happen. You know, the mind generates the thought like an event, and then people at the event, and then people with reactions to oneself at the event. And then on the heel of that, there can often arise, let's say, in my example here, a growing sense of me. I want to look good. I want them to approve of me. Gee, I hope I don't look bad. I hope I don't suck. Whatever. See what I mean? You can see selfing constellating around a stream in the mind. That stream is constituting a self. Right? That's the sense of self right then and there is arising dependently. Inner direct experience. That's what we're seeing in our own experience. And then last, who are we most fundamentally? Clearly, the self is just part of the person. Right? The person who stands, who sits, who looks, who has reactions, who, let's say, gets embarrassed at realizing there are all kinds of other people, and then, there is embarrassment. Let's say there is perception of others, there is embarrassment, there is reflection on that embarrassment, there is a larger field of awareness in which all that is flowing through. Simultaneously, there are sounds, there are memories, there's a history of embarrassment in social settings, whatever. All that's going on. Self is just a tiny subset of that in our direct experience. Okay, any comments or questions so far? Yeah. Yes, you. There's been a lot of conjecture and not much research on this whole question of how people might have an experience of eternity. And in that essay that I was kind of talking about, Eddies in the Stream, I actually tried to think about, in a neurologically plausible way, what's happening in the approach to nirvana. Because in Buddhism, at least, it's quite well operationalized. One of the major, I think of it as the runway to the launch, you know, into nirvana or nibbana. First with the 4 form jhanas and then the 4 formless jhanas. These are non-ordinary states of awareness, somewhat akin to, not exactly the same as traditionally, the samadhis. And if you think about them as very accurate descriptions of what's happening in the mind, you can then think about, gee, what's got to be happening in the brain to be having that mental state, very well described. And then I kind of take it out to what happens when ultimately all signals fall away, yet somehow remarkably, in cessation, there still is some kind of transfer of information from what happens after cessation to the person that transforms irrevocably that person's life. So you might look at that essay for some of my conjectures about that. I won't go further with that right now, but I think people have tried to think about that. James Austin, a wonderful guy, neurologist, has a book called Selfless Insight, where he tried to think about what possibly could be the neurology of Kensho or Satori, because he's his own practitioner. Yeah, one more, and then I'll go. Wasn't the relationship between the internal dialogue and the self? Great question. So what's the relationship between the internal dialogue and the self? Yeah.
And I mean, in the sense of if I could turn off the internal dialogue.
Yeah.
Would that
Yeah, I'm going to talk more about the internal dialogue when I get into the what I alluded to in the beginning about the major neural systems that are involved in the typical state of awareness, where there's a lot of self-present and thinking about the past, projecting into the future, making plans, solving problems, whatnot, versus when there's much more of a kind of a mindful, spacious, fairly selfless state of mind. So I'll talk more about that. One thing one can do with regard to the internal dialogue is to disidentify from it. There is internal dialogue. There is sound, there is sight, there is internal dialogue, but not privilege it. That's the trick. In other words, as I get to you in a minute, now I'm really going to get into the hardcore stuff here about the self and the brain and what I think the actual, to kind of fast forward here, why self is like a unicorn. In other words, I think there are a lot of representations of self in the mind and therefore the brain, but that which they point to does not exist. And I'll get to that in a few minutes here. But what one can do with the internal dialogue is just there is chatter. There is the voice in the head. There are many voices. It's a freaking committee up there, isn't it? It's a menagerie. It's a zoo. And, you know, I don't know how many of you are therapists, but it's a great therapeutic technique to help people disidentify from those voices, and in particular, you know, particularly disidentify from ones that are problematic. Like right here, I'll take it one step further. Like right there, speaking of embarrassment, I could observe selfing increasing in the mind, you know, with little thoughts on the order of, do I look like a fool? What happened? It's nothing. Everyone's laughing at me, you know, and the mind is producing all that. Now the trick, of course, is to not necessarily make them special. It's not a problem that thoughts of self arise. The problem is when we privilege them, when we make self more than just one more subpersonality, or just one more voice, or one more stream. That's when suffering really, really begins.
Do we do that? Do you think that we actually do that?
Routinely privilege self?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think we do it all.
In the West? You don't think people privilege the sense?
But I think prior to the thought that I'm being something,
okay.
A relationship between something you can call who you think you are.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Because if that's not there, there wouldn't be any worry about it.
Yeah, in that sense, sure. The privileging of self is itself dependently arising. That's what you're saying, right? It arises on other things that happened before. But the direct experience in the immediacy of it is that when one does not privilege self, that perspective of I, which very often shows up, this is where Buddhism has a very good analysis of self. Self tends to arise around identification, possession, and agency. So when we, you know, we know that experience, right? When we identify with something, or we don't. Like, do I need to identify with that sound? Like, is it my fault that weird feedback noise happened, you know? Or not. As identification with that increases, selfing constellates, we can observe it in our experience, and then the seeds are planted for awkwardness, embarrassment, and mini micro suffering in the front of the room. Right? Whoops. Okay, there you go again. Anyway, I want to keep going here, but isn't this interesting to watch? And I think it's very freeing to relax some about self, not so much take up arms against it, but rather change our relationship to selfing as one more mental content like any other. There is sound, there is sight, there is desire, there is selfing. So now, if I could, I want to talk about self in the brain, all right? It's really far out. So normally I do this with slide sets, and if you want, you can go on both my personal site, rickhanson.net, as well as wisebrain.org, and see the slide sets of different workshops I've done on not self, as well as other slide sets. And I'll just go through a few of them. So first of all, they've done studies where they put people in MRI scanners and they ask them different kinds of self-related questions. Like, can you recognize a picture of who's you in this picture versus other people? Or push this button when you see yourself, right? Your own face. Can you recognize your face? Some animals can, right? Porpoises can, some other great apes can, cats can't. recognize themselves. So that's kind of a measure there. Or another one is, what's a personal memory? Recall something personal about your childhood, how you spent your summer vacation, recently what you had for breakfast, or make a tough decision. Like make a, decide whether, you think this or that, whatever. The point is that when people do that, the parts of the brain that light up are all over the place. In other words, self is compounded in the brain. Self is not, remember those four conditions of the Western self? It's unified, it's enduring, it's independent, and it's the identity. Well, it's not unified. It's all over the brain. And very interestingly, of the places in the brain that do tend to particularly light up when we do self-related activities, like the ones I said, or other sorts of things, they also are used in the brain for all kinds of other functions. In other words, in the brain, self is not special. I think of self as, you use the eddies in the stream metaphor, as just a swirl of twigs and leaves, kind of as self-organizing in a momentary way. It emerges, it stabilizes, it persists, it bumps into other eddies in the brain. It leads us in a body with our actions with thought, word, and deed to bump into other people, and then it kind of disperses again. But during that moment, that particular eddy that is selfing in the stream of mind and brain is just one more eddy. It's just one more content swirling through the river of mind and therefore the river of the nervous system as an ongoing dynamic streaming. It's not special. Talk about a neurological basis for not privileging self. The brain doesn't privilege self. Okay? Another thing is that it's endlessly transient. And if, when you watch what happens, it's like I said with that amplifier idea, lights go up here, they go down there, it moves around. Self is very transient in the brain. It's very impermanent. It also arises dependently. Selfing activates in different parts of the brain depending on stimuli, depending on internal reflections. For example, bring to mind, a very embarrassing moment or a sense of being rejected or cast out, that will tend to constellate a lot of self. On the other hand, maybe bring to mind some really cool reward that's just out of reach these days and you're driving for it, that will also tend to activate a whole bunch of self. Selfing arises dependently. Again, it's not independent. And then last, clearly, in the brain, the circuits that are engaged with self or selfing are a tiny fraction of all the neurons and synapses and neural assemblies that arise in the brain. In other words, self or selfing as process is just the neural substrate, moment to moment, of selfing. It's just a tiny fraction of all the neural activity going on. Right there again, self is a part of the whole. It's not the whole. Now here's,
Are you making a distinction between self and the perception of self? Because it sounds to me like you're talking about the perception of self and not self.
It's hard. Well, let's say a person is gets down to, I want. Right? I want. Or I hate, or I love. Who's that I? That's the ordinary Western psychological I, right? I have, I belong to, I am. Yeah? I am curious, I am excitable, I am calm. Yeah? I am male, I am female. Yeah? The I there is the I I'm talking about. There can be awareness of the activations and deactivations and endless changes of that I. There can also be more peripheral, or not quite the right word, but less central aspects of self, such as the recognition of sort of identification with personal history, memories over time. When I was 19, I this. Or last year, my family and I did it, right? There can be an awareness of all that. What I'm saying in the brain is that when various manifestations of self, various acts, in other words, representations of self, self-related functions like choosing, or identifying with or possessing or wanting or not wanting, those activations happen all over the place in the brain, and they're just a part of the whole. And I want to talk about the fundamental notion of subjectivity, because that then is really the, if you think about it, in other words, I've listened to me say this, and then I thought, like, okay, but what about that very fundamental sense of being a being who has experiences, right? Moment to moment. It really feels like that, doesn't it? And this is where there's a lot of very interesting work in philosophy and in neurology around what is subjectivity, right? And I highly recommend a book called Mind in Life from Evan Thompson, who's just great and brilliant. It's heavy lifting, but it's worth your while. Confession, I took it on retreat one time, and it and Ajahn Chah really took me way out into anatta, not self. So it's a really great book. The point, though, is that if you think about it, there does seem to be need to be an irreducible subjectivity in experience, in the sense that experiencing occurs with reference to and from the perspective of a particular body-mind. Right? Your experiencing is different from my experiencing by its very nature. It would be to feel that one, that experiencing is not localized within a body-mind and from a particular perspective, moment to moment to moment, is psychotic and deeply disturbing. Deeply disturbing. On the other hand, if you look closely, what the brain does is that even though there's this inherent subjectivity, it indexes across moments of subjectivity, you know, like 6 times a second. And indexing across what, all that's there is subjectivity. Subjectivity is here. There is subjectivity, right? That's what we know. But then what the brain does is it indexes across all those little moments of subjectivity to find an enduring subject. The I, who is looking out through the eyes, and to whom things happen, right? But on the other hand, if you look closely at experience, there is no subject inherent in subjectivity. There's just subjectivity. There's just things are happening that are related to or from the perspective of this particular body-mind that are manifesting inside this particular brain, but it's a leap. We're adding something to say that there actually is a subject. So my fundamental take, and then we can talk about this, I'm sure we'll talk about it, is that in sum, from a neurological standpoint, the everyday view that there is a unified self is an illusion. It's not true. In other words, the apparently coherent and solid I in the brain is actually built from many neural subsystems with no fixed center. It's compounded and distributed. It's a network phenomenon. It's an emergent network phenomenon. It's not localized anywhere inside the nervous system or the brain. There's no little homunculus, no little man or woman looking out, you know, through the eyes from somewhere in the pineal gland, right? There isn't. The apparently stable I is produced by endlessly variable and transient neural activations and deactivations. And the apparently independent I is depends on neural circuitry, the evolutionary processes that produce them, because a chimpanzee doesn't have much sense of self. It has some sense of self. He or she has some sense of self, but not as much as a human does. So in other words, self arises dependently in the nervous system. Neurologically, fundamentally, self is empty. In the brain, self does not have any kind of absolute self-arising existence. It's empty. Now, I've struggled with language like self is not real or there is no self. Right? People say there is no self. And I say, well, what do you mean? Like, for example, there is an experience that there's an eye here that's coherent and stable looking out through these eyes, right? Or there is strong identification. Mess with my kids? Oh, baby, you're in trouble. You know, there is that sense that comes up. Or there's that wistful sense of longing that goes back to my childhood of wishing for more love and approval. Those things are there. Well, people say self is not real. Those thoughts, those mental activities are as real as the knowledge that 2 + 2 = 4. Or the recollection right now of where your car is parked. Those arise. They exist. They have existence. Their nature of immaterial thought is, really not understood. But people grant that the memory of where your car is or the knowledge of what 2 + 2 is exists. Therefore, the neural substrate that is a necessary and proximally sufficient condition for that thought exists. In the same way, thoughts of self exist, right? But what do they point to? Just because we have a sense of self doesn't mean we are a self in the way I'm defining it, as in the conventional I, me, or mine sort of way. And this is where I think self is like the unicorn. In other words, in the brain are many representations of horses, right? Those representations are real. They exist. They have existence in the ordinary sense of, this cup exists. I think this cup exists, right? There is no spoon, all right, in some sense, but I think there is a cup, right? So what those representations of a horse point to is real. On the other hand, there are representations of a unicorn, right? But we all know, or most of us do at least, that there is no unicorn, right? It's not real in the sense that a horse is real. Sorry. But I think self is much the same. There are many representations of self. There are many presumptions of self. There are mental contents like other mental contents, like sounds, like wishes, like memories, like knowledge, like views, politics, all the rest of that. But that which those representations point to, the unified, stable, independent identity, fundamentally does not exist. In that fundamental sense, I think self is like a unicorn.
Or can't be perceived in its totality. I mean, what's the difference between I can't perceive it in its totality and it doesn't exist?
I don't understand your question.
You're talking about, all that you're talking about is the perception that popped up into our mind about who we think we are. The perception of myself. I mean, there's all these identities that I have. But that's a perception of these identities. I think what you're saying doesn't exist actually exists behind the perception as the capital I, the real self, but we can't say anything about it because we can just point to the totality of whatever it might be. And that's all we can say. We can sort of define a container for it. But there is something back there that is the primary perceiver that sees all these representations that we identify as not being real. But we forget sometimes and are real, but we can say right now, okay, those are just identities, that's not me. I agree. But behind that is a perception of all those identities coming from somewhere.
Right. Your assertion is that that there is a subject, a primary perceiver, which I consider synonymous with the word subject, that there is a primary perceiver who or which perceives representations of self. Like, for example, ideas that I am a certain way. I am male, I am a Democrat, I live in Berkeley, whatever. Okay? Right? And there may be. I think first it is the case that when people look deeply into their experience, particularly when the mind gets very, very quiet, that sense of a primary perceiver people can routinely report that it falls away. See for yourself what you think, but the primary perceiver falls away. And there is awareness, there is perceiving, there's no one doing the perceiving. When we use language like primary perceiver, we're describing it's a noun, there's an entity there in some way. There's a stable functioning that's occurring. And in my own personal practice, I find that this issue that you raise is enormously legitimate and important, because it to me is the thorniest one. People can get that the sense of self that increases or decreases when we make eye contact with someone, or that changes when the other person smiles or frowns or looks away dismissively, what have you, that sense of self rising and falling is relatively peripheral, really. But the nubbin is exactly what you're talking about. This question of whether there is indeed a primary perceiver and what the notion of that primary perceiver or subject is, and ultimately does that primary perceiver partake of the divine? That often is where people go with that. And then larger questions are, is that primary perceiver a soul? Does it exist? Does it transfer from life to life? And to that, I'm going to tell you, I'm not going to assert a definitive answer because I don't know. And, you know, yay. And also, I have my hopes. And sometimes, honestly, I experience that there really is a weirdly enduring primary perceiver that does seem to be at the heart of things. And I've had some very interesting experiences. On the other hand, there are people like the Buddha and others who radically deconstruct that notion of the primary perceiver. What I will say for me, when you think about evidence, is that one, many people report, me included, that in very deep states of contemplation, that sense of a primary perceiver falls away. And there is simply awareness and its objects, and it's not even a dualistic distinction between awareness and their objects. There's just awareness object, you know, or as Andy Alinsky, as a Buddhist teacher, says, consciousness is not a thing, it's a process, you know, right? There is a wearing, right? And a wearing usually has objects, although I think as the brain gets incredibly quiet in the run-up to states of awakening or some other state, maybe there really is awareness without an object. Okay, so that's day number one, that the primary perceiver does seem to be not present in experience, you know, in certain kinds of experiences. Number two, so far at least, you can't find a primary perceiver in the brain. You can't find a subject in the brain. And what you find in the brain is all kinds of stuff going on related to, including subjectivity, that is widely distributed. What I think is most useful, personally, is to engage this question pragmatically, not philosophically. I think it's interesting to engage conceptually, and it helps to kind of, you know, clarify the distinctions. But the ultimate question is, you know, what I think there are many ultimate questions, but an ultimate question, of course, is what leads to happiness and helpfulness versus what leads to suffering and harm, right? And so within that, for me, kind of Buddhist frame, if you will, also the frame of a therapist, you know, what helps and what hurts? You know, it's the Dr. Phil question. How's that working for you, right? How is selfing working for you? Like for me, selfing leads to suffering. As soon as I start identifying with something, that which I'm identifying with is inherently transient. Subject to conditions, it arises, it disperses, and passes away. When I try to possess something, suffering begins, because that which I try to possess arises, disperses, and passes away, right? Including in very classic Western psychological terms, when I worry about narcissistic supplies, when I get caught up in what people think of me, when I get really attached to, you know, my view prevailing, right? Like here and now, like if I get attached to my me right, whatever, guess what? Suffering begins, suffering and harms begin. On the other hand, when there is growing disidentification with selfing, when there is even, when there is simply a dropping increasingly into the immediacy of experiencing, then I think there is increasingly happiness and helpfulness. Okay. What do you think about that? Yeah. About what? Right. Right, that's why self as Atman, say, or in a Vedanta sense. So he, I don't know if you heard him, and I don't think I can fully do justice to the subtlety, really, of what you were getting at, but maybe I'll just comment that there's an important distinction between the obviousness of being, right? There is being, right? Or as Winnicott, the great British child a therapist pointed out, it's incredibly important for a child to experience that there is a going on beingness. Right? There is being. There is being here. There are sounds, there is thought, there is being. But just because there is being does not necessarily mean that there is a being. That's the distinction. And I find lots of times people conflate the two. Just because there is being does not necessarily mean that there is a being. I think it's relevant to say that there is a person in the sense, yeah, there are bodies, you know, all that, that have personality and history and certain qualities and all that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there's a primary experiencer or an even more Western conventional notion of self. I want to try to buy time here for a bit of a practice, too. So, yeah. Yeah. She's getting at the uses of self. And, if I got it right, she was saying, tell me if I don't do justice to it. Yeah, it was basically saying, on the other hand, self has its uses. And also, it does seem interesting that, what do we do when self really activates, right? Like there's a kind of a Zen story, it's a true story, was telling his Zen master, this kind of frail old guy from Japan, that that he, the American, had really realized a lot of deep things about impermanence and had relaxed his fear of death, right? And then instantly the Zen master jumped up and started strangling the American dude, who could not pry his skinny little fingers from his throat. And then finally the Zen master relaxed, and he said, so where is that fear of death now? I think it's important to be humble. And it's one little thing, right, for me to sit here and just kind of laugh at negative feedback in the mic. It's another thing to have a teenage daughter who, thinks you're a putz. I've been there. Whoa, a lot of self constellates around that one. Right? Yeah. I also, to take it a step further, iconoclast that I am, deep down, rebel that I am, it's that I think about the difference between what it means and the impact between saying, for example, there is a lot of love here in the indeterminately arising space between us versus I love you, right? What do we want to hear? We want to hear someone say, there's a lot of non-localized love arising.
In this.
Depends on who's saying it, right. On the other hand, do we want to have someone, I've done a fair amount of rock climbing, and I tell you, when the chips start falling and you really got a deal, there's a place for a strong sense of self, like, I am going to get through this, or someone's messing with one you care about. I think of Gandalf at the bridge, Bardur, I shall not pass. There's a place for that. And I think that's one of the reasons why self capacities evolved and are so intractable, because they do perform very good they confer great reproductive advantages, which is the engine of biological evolution. So I think one of the takeaways from reflecting about sort of evolutionary neuropsychology from this framework that's utilitarian to practice, what helps, what hurts, is to appreciate how challenging it is, actually, how many wholesome practices swim against the stream. And that, to me, goes to compassion and also realizing, whoa, we need to make effort here. We need to be resolute. But I think what happens in the beginning, in terms of practice, is that it's fun to practice with mild activations and deactivations of selfing, and it gets increasingly more powerful to deal with more and more intense activations. And I think at the ultimate, we have around us today and in the historical record many, many beings who either were completely awakened, enlightened, liberated, whatever term we want to use, God realized, whatever term we want, or close to it. And the thing that does seem to be reliably the case around them is, under intense circumstances, they don't get self-activations. And in Buddhism, the Buddha described just kind of as a quite well operationalized psychologically, in a good translation, roadmap for relaxing the sense of self, the conceit of self, as he said, which, by the way, he said, does not fully go until the fourth and final stage of enlightenment, the arahant. So, you know, we have a ways, right? It's challenging. But it's interesting, I had a friend who lived in Asia as a monk for 9 years, and I, of course, asked him the question, you know, did you meet any enlightened people? Like, you know, that's the question, right, as I had. And he said, well, in that tradition, you don't think someone's really enlightened until you've lived with them for 10 years or so. Because it's day to day, right? That goes back to that story, the people who are awakened who come home for Christmas and get into a lot of trouble, or Hanukkah, or the holidays, right? So first of all, that's that. And I said, okay, but really, did you meet some people who were considered enlightened? He said, yeah, well, there were a few, or were very, very close to it. I said, all right, what were they like? He said, well, two things. First, they had a lot of energy. They were very productive. They didn't seem to need much sleep, and they just kept going, you know? And the second thing, they were always the same. What do you mean? I asked. He said, well, if you were nice to them, they really loved you. If you were awful to them, they really loved you. Like, it was just, you know, the whole, they might make decisions, you know, like, create boundaries, set you out of the monastery. I think there's no shortage of effective social action from these days that have come from people like the Dalai Lama or Thich Nhat Hanh or others who are, I think are quite realized. I think that speaks to the possibilities here. So we do our practices along the way. And often what's helpful is that even when we're completely hijacked by self, right, even if there's only that 1%, that little quiet voice, maybe it's the primary perceiver. I have had that sense, that wisdom in the back that says, it's selfing. Ride the wave. Don't do something stupid. Shut up. You know, that 1% could keep us out of a lot of trouble. Okay. Maybe one more person, and then let's do a practice. Okay, two more people, and we'll do a practice. Question is, and I'm being recorded, where do I think Daffy John was on that spectrum? I just don't know. Honestly, I feel like many, I'll say it like this about him, and I think it's true for other people, a number of other people as well, that that there were so many times where he really did seem to be a clear window for the light of the divine to shine through. And you read, for example, like I'd rather read the saints than the theologians. That's kind of a saying I have for myself. You read these people, and clearly, whew, something's coming through. Wham. You know, and it just it, I feel a little bit like the mind starts sublimating like dry ice, frozen carbon dioxide. It goes from solid to gas. Just, right? And there are other people, and yet, not all, but some of these people also seemingly could have times when the window was not perfectly transparent and there were obscurations which then led them to do things that were harmful to others. And you see that in many traditions. I think that was the case there, with no disrespect. No. Okay, one more and then that's it.
And you're talking about a close observation where a person is deeply meditating and
Thank you. So just to kind of catch for other people the, a couple high points from what you said, this is I got them, an observation that as there as practice continues, paradoxically, as there is less sense of the little s self, there's a growing sense of the capital S self. That would be a way of saying what you're saying, I think. And then I just think it's important to be attentive to what we mean when we talk about the capital S self. In other words, is the capital S self personal? You know, is it, or would it be more accurate to say something like, there is Godding, in effect? You know, I don't know. And to use the language also a little carefully, it is also interesting is that one becomes increasingly less inclined to take things personally or to get caught up in ego. When one also, and this is an important topic we probably don't have time to do, when one also heals narcissistic injuries. In other words, when one heals breakdowns in what should have occurred in childhood in terms of attuning to and nurturing and prizing the apparent self, the unicorn. In other words, isn't it interesting that healthy childhood development requires a lot of treating of the unicorn as if it's real? And then isn't that a paradox? And then if it's not treated as if it's real, if it's not attuned to and cherished and approved of and prized, that can create a lot of problems. I mean, this is a whole can of worms, so we had another hour. We could really talk about this one. And my quick view there is that something that's been very important for me, and I think for other people as well, is to deliberately, as an intermediate practice, heal the psychological self as a strategy for transcending the psychological self. But to use the metaphor of the Buddha, the raft, we confront a river of suffering, we build a raft to get across the stream. Once we're across the stream, we don't carry that vehicle around our heads anymore. We set it down. So I've actually gone through a long period of time using one of the methods in my book called Taking in the Good to really internalize experiences of being loved and approved of and cherished and cared about, to take those supplies in so that actually selfing can relax and there isn't so much greedy, reactive grasping for that love and belonging and recognition from other people. But the trick of it, of course, is to know why you're doing it. Are you doing it out of vanity, right? Or is one doing it out of kindness toward oneself, as one being among many, to take in those critically important supplies so ultimately you can move beyond them? So anyways, one does all that, yeah. There's often a growing sense of the person, or I, in that sense of I as the person, gets more here, is more grounded, and has more to offer to others. Yeah. I think that's right. That's exact. Yeah, you really see that. They're just... I just want to see if there's one more thing. It's don't take self personally. That's what we're saying. In other words, as it arises, don't take it personally. It's an arising. It's a construction. It arises. It disperses. It passes away. You know, then it's not a problem. It becomes a problem when we attach to it, identify with it, or act from it. How about we do a quick practice here? You've been very patient, and it's a couple minutes to nine, so I'm going to go a few minutes over, but very close to ending. I'm very happy to stick around, by the way, afterward, and you can contact me. It's easy to find my email address. It's on my website, wisebrain.org, and also rickhanson.net. Okay, so I want to set this practice up briefly. It's interesting that in the recent studies have shown that when we engage conventional self-related activities, like thinking about a personally related problem, or thinking about ourselves, like who am I this kind of person or that kind of person, or how to work it with other people, we tend to activate midline circuits. Whereas interestingly, when we go into just kind of spacious, mindful awareness of something, just being present with it, you know, there is sound, there is sensation, there is thought, then we light up these lateral circuits, especially in the right-hand side of the brain. This is a very new area, pardon me, of research. It's very cool. It's also very interesting that if you look at some of the distinctions between this lateral area. Here we go. Sorry about that. So midline, it tends to be representational with concepts and language. Lateral network activation, concrete and immediate. Midline, future or past focused. Lateral, be here now. It's getting interesting, isn't it? All right. So midline, abstract. Lateral, concrete. Midline, goal-directed, you know, purposive, task-oriented, problem, solution, focused, dealing with threats, dealing with opportunities. Lateral, a sense of contentment and peace. It's all okay as it is. Medial, craving, well, I'll just say another thing. Medial, self. Massive amounts of self in the midline, lateral, not self. So the capacity to light up those lateral networks seems worth training. Interestingly, studies have shown that the ordinary person can very briefly light up lateral networks. So for example, if you ask them to do a task where they are to think about whether certain adjectives apply to them, like friendly, curious, lazy, ambitious, irritable, anxious, whatever, you can light up the midline. If you just say, no, now I want you just to see those words and be kind of spaciously aware of whatever comes to mind without trying to do anything, they can light up these lateral networks for about 3 seconds, maybe five. But then that activation gets hijacked and co-opted by the tyrant of the midline. If you also think about the way we educate children, the conventional school system is an intense training in medial activation. So is the culture today, right? So I think native peoples and also people in, you know, hunter-gatherer cultures are much more prone to lateral activation. On the other hand, studies have shown that even in just like a 6 or 8 week, kind of not much of a big deal mindfulness course, people can stably sustain lateral activation. So being able to move back and forth, not, you know, they're both important. And I think people who are really, really realized and integrated can do that very subtly. But along the way, given the way in which medial activation is highly privileged in our culture, enormously trained. Neurons that fire together, wire together. We're firing medial-related activities all day long and thus deepening these networks. Being able to increasingly activate lateral activation is very useful. So I want to name a few practices that can do that are kind of neurologically clever. And so we'll do that practice. I'll offer a quote from the Buddha, and then we'll bring it to an end, all in a few minutes. So, because you're seasoned, I feel I can just go right here. Here we go. So, ready? Follow, and you can ignore my suggestions and don't do anything that's uncomfortable. So take a big breath with a long exhalation. And focus on the sensations of breathing or some other aspect of the body or even sight if breathing is uncomfortable. Breath in the belly, the chest, cool air coming in, warm air going out, sensations at the upper lip. Let attention settle into breathing as if it's sinking into a very comfortable warm bath. Be aware of how attention tends to move from one sensation of the breath to another one, from one location to another. And instead, see if you can be aware of each breath as a whole. In other words, the sensations of inhaling or exhaling experienced as a whole, as one single percept. This sense often crumbles after it's experienced briefly. It's all right. See if you can regenerate it again for the next several breaths. then see if you can expand the sense of the breath as a whole to a sense of the body as a whole, sitting and breathing. Rather than having attention flicker from location to location, relax and open out into a sense of the body as a single gestalt, as a unified person. Multiple sensations of the body arising as a whole. Staying grounded in the body, open awareness out to whatever is moving through the mind. And allow whatever is moving through the mind not to mean anything or to be related to anything else. Contents arising and passing away without needing them to stitch together. Presence, contents of mind come and go, not needing to know what they are, not needing for them to mean anything, not needing to identify with them or claim them. Like an open, boundless space where rich thoughts and sensations pass like clouds across the sky. Awareness of experience like the view from an airplane 30,000 feet up. A bird, panoramic, open and wide. sense of spaciousness to continue as we bring this meditation to a close, knowing that you did four things that are known to light up, to activate these lateral networks. Relaxing, as in a long exhalation. Awareness of the whole, as in the whole breath of the whole body. Third, not stitching contents of mind together or needing them to mean anything. And fourth, taking a panoramic view of open, boundless awareness. You're opening your eyes if you like and seeing if you can sustain this sense of openness and presence, ease, nothing to do, no problem to solve, no one to be. And in closing, I'd like to offer this teaching from the Buddha to Bahia, who asked for the Buddha's teachings, and the Buddha gave him his teachings in a very, very summary way, which then led to Bahia's awakening on the spot, or so it said. Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. In reference to the heard, there will be only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, to the thought, there will only be thought. When for you there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in the heard, only the sensed in the sensed, only the cognized in the cognized, then the here. There's no you in that. When there's no you in that, there's no you there. When there's no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of all suffering. So may our sincerity and our attention and our practice tonight help free ourselves and others from suffering and its causes. So thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us, Rick,
and
I hope you come back another time.
Oh, my pleasure.